Case 22-1499, Jimmy Marshall versus Wayne County, Michigan, et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Emanuel, you may proceed for the appellant. Thank
you. If it may please the court, Lennox Emanuel on behalf of the appellant, Jimmy Marshall, and I reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Fine.
Your Honor, there are two issues before the court here. First is a 12B6 ruling by the district court with respect to Mr. Marshall's ADA claim. And as a principal matter, one of the elements of an ADA claim, of course, is to show that an individual is qualified to perform the job requirements with or without accommodations or reasonable accommodations. And in this case, we have presented indisputable evidence, and we've always maintained that Mr. Marshall was capable of performing the essential elements of his job without requirements. He had done that for 27 years.
How do you deal with Dr. Carmo's statement that he couldn't come back until it was dealt with?
Well, Dr. Carmo, and we dispute some of the methodology used by Dr. Carmo, who is a psychiatrist, but didn't perform.
Wasn't he your doctor?
No. Dr. Carmo is the physician for Wayne County. No, that's Dr. Ager. Sorry, Dr. Carmo. Here's the issue with Dr. Carmo, Your Honor. He was not a psychiatrist, and what he did was.
But he was your doc, right?
Yes.
He did say he couldn't come back to work, right?
Correct. But he did that under the FMLA designation. And I refer the court to the case of Henschel versus Clare County Road Commission, in which this court remanded the case back to the Eastern District of Michigan. Because in that case, in the Henschel case, an individual was disabled for Social Security disability purposes. And that ruling was adopted.
Wait, can I just walk back? So let me give you a hypothetical, take it out of this case. Plaintiff has a doctor that says, I cannot come back to work until X is dealt with. And assume the leave time runs out, whatever they're off for. You're saying the company can say, no, we reject that, we're making you come back to work, or we're going to fire you?
I don't get what the...
Okay, let me give you an example. I'll use the last case. Your employee leaves for COVID purposes.
Correct.
And they have breathing problems. And the doctor sends in a note and says, look, he no longer has COVID, but he has breathing problems, he can't come back to work until I clear him. The company can command that he come back to work and fire him if he doesn't. I'm taking yours and putting it in a hypothetical where a different thing happens.
Well, no, the company can't demand that he come back to work. But
so what could Wayne County do here with the declaration from, or the thing from Carmo that said he can't come back to work, I can't remember, until a psychiatrist clears him or something to that effect?
Well, first of all, we assert that Dr. Carmo was not qualified to make that decision. Dr. Carmo is a general physician. He's not a psychiatrist.
I understand that. Put yourself in the company's position, or in this sense, Wayne County's position.
Okay.
Can they command the person still come back to work? Can they make that determination that doctor is not qualified? That's what you see what I'm saying?
Right.
I get what you're saying now. I totally understand your argument. My point is, put yourself in their position. Can they command he come back to work in spite of what a doctor has told them?
They shouldn't, but Your Honor, that's not the factual predicate here or the factual situation. Because first...
But you are asking that they ignore that. That's my point.
Well, no, I'm not asking that they ignore that because the facts here are he was first put out of work by their IME physician. But that has never been relied on by any of the courts in the ruling by the lower court. He was then disabled under the FMLA designation 15 days later by his own physician, who frankly was just parroting what had been provided to him by the IME physician, the Wayne County IME physician. But we have to evaluate this, Your Honor, within the four corners of the Henschel rule. It says that if someone is disabled for or under a disability regimen that differs materially from the ADA definition of what's a qualified individual with a disability, it is not conclusive as to an ADA definition.
Right, but the statement by Dr. Carmo was that his patient had a personality disorder and could not return to work until cleared by a psychiatrist. And so how was your client qualified to return to work at that point?
And that's where we go within the four corners of the Henschel decision. The court says you are then allowed to present facts to show that you can, in fact, perform the job. And so I will refer the court to the facts. For 27 years, my client had performed the job, which involved some complex...
But couldn't he have... I don't think the question, at least my understanding of this case, I don't think the question was could he do the work of the particular job, but the question was did he have a psychiatric problem that would prevent him from doing the physical work of the job?
And that's our position. No, he did not. Even if he had a psychiatric impairment, he was able to perform the job. And there is no evidence that he, to the contrary, Your Honor, for 27 years, and I keep emphasizing that point, for 27 years, he had performed the job, which required some complex elements of the essential functions of the job and some manual labor. But he had performed both without ever being disciplined, without a letter of reprimand, a warning.
How did this start, this idea that he had a paranoid personality disorder? What was the first document or other event that caused that?
And Your Honor hit the nail on the point. There is nothing. There is nothing in the record. And during discovery, nothing was provided to us that would support that conclusion. There are some...
You mentioned the IME, the employer's internal medical examiner. Did that person have a meeting with your client or someone?
They did. It was a 45-minute meeting. They didn't examine any medical records, but they based that diagnosis on an interview with my client where they concluded, well, he'd had some recent bereavement in the family. He talked supposedly about harassment at work, which was true. He talked about other employees tampering with his food and tampering with his bike. And they concluded that based on that, he was having these kind of mental impairments. But there isn't any evidence.
And then go ahead. So then the requirement of this IME was that he needed to have some kind of consultations with people or some interactions before he would be suitable to return to work, right?
That is correct. And it may have also included taking some psychotropic medication. But the facts are clear. Does your own have a question?
Well, I'm just wondering about the timeline. So then is that when your client then gets Dr. Carmo to do the exam, his own evaluation?
No, he doesn't. So he gets the IME by their doctor who says you have to do these X number of things. And so they then tell him that you're no longer eligible for short-term disability. You need to go on FMLA leave. So the human resources person at Wayne County fills out the FMLA form for him. They call his doctor.
Dr. Shonda Brooks?
Yes, that's right.
And you're not pursuing a claim against her anymore, correct?
No, just to make this a little more precise, we're not at this
okay,
point.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Sure, Your Honor. So Ms. Brooks calls up his physician and says, kind of disingenuously, he needs to go on FMA leave. We're all in this corner. We need this to get done. They send the Dr. Ager's report to Dr. Carmo, and Dr. Carmo is under the impression, well, I'm doing a favor to this individual here, so just he signs off without doing any of the testing. So he signs off 15 days after the IME by Wayne County has already put my client off of work. But again, Your Honor, there is nothing in the record, and I asked the court to review the record.
He didn't meet with him, or he didn't? When you say he didn't do his own examination, he just signed off. He didn't.
My client went there, but there wasn't any review of medical records. There wasn't any real in-depth examination. That's what he did. He basically signed off on the form under the impression he was helping Mr. Marshall by designating him as an FMLA individual.
But I guess this goes back to Judge Sipar's question. The employer doesn't know any of that, right?
They do, because they instigated. Remember, Ms. Brooks calls up.
But you're saying that Dr. Carmo's exam was not a real exam. It was just a phony exam.
Right.
How is the employer supposed to know that? I mean, that's the disconnect, I guess, on this, for this claim.
Well, maybe the employer doesn't need to know that, Your Honor, but the employer didn't base their ouster of Mr. Marshall based on Dr. Carmo's examination. They had already put him out of work 15 days before he met with Dr. Carmo. They had written him a letter saying, our IME found that you have these issues, and these are the things you need to do before you can report to work. So the decision to keep Mr. Marshall out of work was based on the IME done by the Wayne County.
But my understanding was that the letter from Wayne County conditioned his return to work on the completion of 6 therapy sessions and clearance from a board-certified psychiatrist of his choosing. So the ball was sort of thrown into your client's court to do various things, and then he could come back to work.
Well, then they would consider whether he would come back to work. There wasn't any clear determination that he would be allowed back to work. But this was done with the clear understanding that Mr. Marshall probably would not accede to those demands. And there's an email from one of the attorneys from Wayne County who basically says that we don't think Mr. Marshall will accede to these requirements. This was clearly a pretextual issue to get Mr. Marshall out of work. Because here's how it happened, Your Honor. He's suspended for 5 days. He's allowed to work 7 days before the suspension, again, without any incident, without any determination that he couldn't perform the essential functions of the job. And on the fifth day, just when he's about to come back to work, they hand deliver a letter to him saying, you should not come back to work. You need to go to this IME. The IME then conveniently says, you can't go back to work unless you do these conditions. They knew Mr. Marshall was not going to accede to that requirement. And so their position was, well, you can't come back to work until all of this is done. 15 days later, he gets FMLA leave because Dr. Carmo signs off. But the FMLA designation is not designed to assess whether or not you are ADA qualified. For instance, under the FMLA, Your Honor, a qualified individual can get leave to care for a loved one.
Right.
So it's not a designation that's used to determine whether you are ADA qualified. And that's why I am urging this court to allow this 12B6 dismissal to move forward, because Mr. Marshall can clearly demonstrate that he was capable of performing the essential functions of his job without an accommodation, and that even if he was diagnosed with a mental impairment, that never affected his 27 years of performance. In 27 years,
Your Honor, red light has been on for a few minutes, so I'm afraid I'll have to let you save any remaining time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Alan Venable on behalf of the appellees. I believe that it's clear. The lower court's decision regarding the Title VII claim, the equal protection claim, the ADA claim, and the due process claim should be affirmed. Dealing first with the Title VII and the equal protection claim, well, let's deal first with the ADA claim. I think the court has hit the ball out of the park when it deals with the direct issue that he was not a qualified individual under the ADA. His own doctor made a psychiatric determination from a review of the appellant in person that he was not able to return to work for approximately 9 months, and he would have to be cleared by a psychiatrist within that period to deal with his issues. On that basis alone, he is not a qualified individual under this court's precedence, and Henshaw and no other case looks at this in any other way. We also cite Cabal, I believe the case is, which says that when a plaintiff asserts a conclusion, even though they assert that conclusion as a factual determination or a fact in general, it does not change its character. If it is not proven as a matter of law, it does not move forward. So we believe the 12B6 decision related to that ADA claim should stand. As it relates to the Title VII and the disparate impact claims, the key issue there is the conduct of the employee. And whether that conduct, being the same or similar as another employee, in this case being a minority employee and a non-minority employee, was the same and whether they received the same conduct from the employer in terms of the treatment. And the conduct here was not the same. It was not the same. Now,
what do you mean? I thought they both didn't mop.
I'm sorry, you heard what?
Am I wrong? I thought they both didn't mop. I thought the conduct was the same.
Well,
they both failed to mop, and I get your point that ultimately I can't, Croser or whatever his name is, mopped, but I thought your friend's complaint is that the first, Marshall's notice was written, whereas the other gentleman's was oral. Am I correct about that? Is it Crozier? Who's the other person? Crossman
and Russo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, both of them received a written because both of them had the policy dictating what they needed to do in terms of mopping.
He posted a message to Marshall on the board, whereas he orally told.
We do not believe that is dispositive in this matter, particularly because we're looking at each step of the conduct. And they mirror each other moving forward up until one point, whereas both employees failed to do certain tasks. Both employees were advised to correct this situation where they had not performed. However, right there is where the similarity stopped.
If opposing counsel had evidence that all minorities were only advised in writing, whereas white employees were told orally, that would be different?
I'm not sure that would be a difference as it relates to the negotiated collective bargaining process that was put in place between the employees in Wayne County here, but I do know that no such evidence was revealed in discovery, no such argument was made. In fact, no information was ever put forward on the issue of whether or not, after receiving correction and direction from an employee, whether or not Crossman, or when I say evidence was not put forward, I mean by the appellant, whether or not Crossman or the appellant made a decision to continue to work or not continue to work and do the job.
My understanding is that your point is that Crossman was acted differently. Crossman acted differently because he did correct his error and did mop, whereas Marshall never corrected his error and never did the mopping.
Correct.
So that's why you're saying Crossman is not similarly situated to Marshall because Crossman actually corrected his error, whereas Marshall did not, and therefore Marshall went into the employer causing the hearing to have the 5-day suspension for insubordination.
That is correct. That is correct. As to the issue of whether or not this was a legitimate reason, it's a part of a collectively bargained process between the employees of Wayne County and the county itself. They agreed that this process would be embodied within the employee handbook, and the only thing that Russo did was look at the behavior. I asked you to directly mop after you had already failed. So if you'd already been in a situation where you had not mopped twice, he looked at insubordination as it was stated, that refusing to deal with a direct order, and he gave that particular discipline. We don't believe that there's any evidence that that could be a pretext. We don't believe that there's any evidence that, particularly given a negotiated process between the employees that everyone signed off on, that using that process, according to the letter of the law, presents any type of racial animus or discrimination in any respect. As to the due process claim, that merely just goes to the issue of whether or not you got a notice and whether or not you had a fair opportunity to be heard and present your side of the story. And that definitely happened here. As a part of the collective bargaining process, the appellant had a union steward. His union steward was made aware. He was made aware. And all of this happened before the hearing dealing with his discipline. His union steward received the information. They discussed it. He admitted this in his deposition, that he met with the union steward prior to the hearing. Then he went to the hearing, the appellant, with his union steward. Mr. Russo was there. And then they presented the information. Now, the appellant remained silent. He was given his opportunity to speak, and he did not speak. 10 minutes is a long time for three people to sit in a room and stare at one another without saying anything. But that didn't happen. There were things being said. It was being explained to him. It was being told to him. His rights were being discussed. But he chose to remain silent for 10 minutes.
So if I can get back to the ADA claim, which is a little bit troubling in that it was dismissed on 12B6 grounds, when did the examination by the IME occur? Was it during the 5-day suspension, or was it later, or what?
It was not during the 5-day suspension.
So was it later?
I'm not sure whether it was later or not, but I can take a look at it. But I believe that it was later.
So what? Why didn't, so did he come back to work then after the 5-day suspension?
Yes.
And so how, it sort of seems odd that he's been working for 27 years, everything is fine, he doesn't do the mopping, and then he doesn't do the mopping when told to do the mopping. He has this hearing where he doesn't talk, but they explain that he didn't do the mopping, this is insubordination, and therefore he's going to have the 5-day suspension. So he's suspended. And he comes back. What's the rationale for having the IME exam?
Well, he troubled his supervisors and coworkers. They could tell that something was wrong. And again, as a part of the collectively bargained process, there's an employee assistance program designed to deal with these type of issues. If he did not want to go for the IME, he did not have to go. It was voluntary. So he decided to participate in this process.
But we're doing this on the pleadings, right? This is a 12B6 claim.
Correct.
That's being dismissed. I mean, this is a... So is what's defective about the complaint here?
He's not a qualified individual. His own doctor said that he cannot perform the essential functions of the job. And as a result, he cannot move forward. The claim does not involve anything regarding the IME issue with the employer's
So we're basically, position. I apologize that I don't have the complaint in front of me. The complaint, you're saying, on a 12B6, the complaint was insufficient to raise an ADA claim because the complaint itself shows that he is not qualified? Or are we having to look at facts outside the complaint in order to decide this, whether the district judge properly dismissed the ADA claim?
Well, I believe the circumstance was that he didn't provide any facts within the complaint to support the idea that he was a qualified individual, only a conclusion. And because he only put forward the conclusion and no facts, that's why it was dismissed. And that was supported by, I believe, Cabal, which says that you have to put forward facts. You can't put forward a conclusion, even if you're trying to make the conclusion into a factual circumstance. On top of that, we have the situation where his own doctor made the decision that he was not a qualified individual because he said he was not able to perform the essential functions of the job.
And we have to be able to look at that document then, the certification by Carmo saying that he needed to take FMLA leave because of his paranoid affect.
I believe so, but I believe that I'm not sure whether, to be candid, I'm not sure whether that document was attached to the answer or not.
Does the complaint reference the forms? Does the complaint itself reference medical forms, FMLA forms, in as part of the allegations?
I believe it does, Your Honor, because he talks about being on leave at the time that he took his retirement and decided that he was no longer going to work. So this was within the scope of the four corners of the complaint, and I also believe that it was within the four corners of the answer when the responses were being provided and the documents attached there too. So
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm not sure you can expand the record by just attaching things to the answer. I mean, I think if it's fairly encompassed within the complaint, you know, and my understanding, and I don't have the complaint in front of me, is I remember the complaint made specific allegations about these documents or these exams or the forms or whatever that I think would then put them into play in the case. Is that right?
For this analysis, the 12B6, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, and you're saying that's where in paragraphs 40, I do have the complaint, 46 to 48, they refer specifically to those FMLA forms. You're saying that puts it into play?
Yes.
Because the FMLA forms include or attach Dr. Carmo's
medical diagnosis as to his client's status as a qualified individual and whether he could perform the essential functions of the job.
But presumably we can't look at what he says happened or didn't happen in the exam unless it's in his complaint as a statement or in a document that we can refer to because it's referred to in the complaint.
Okay.
You don't have to agree with me. That's fine. I just wanted to clarify how we know anything about the psychiatric situation involving
if I'm understanding the question correctly, and I may not, there's no way for Wayne County to know, there's no way for you to know, there's no way for anyone reading the complaint to know that this supposed FMLA examination was somehow phony or that the appellant was somehow intentionally creating a fraud. But essentially that's what's being argued, that he intentionally created a fraud to get medical leave, and now he wants to retreat from that position because it turns out that if that quote-unquote alleged fraud is taken as the truth, that it would prevent him from having an ADA claim.
But I thought he claims that paragraph 46, the defendant's employer, Rashonda Brooks, altered the prescribed federally mandated wording on the FMLA form, and that no physician completed the mandated sections of the FMLA leave form. So isn't he arguing that to the extent there's a fraud, it was done by Brooks? Not me.
That's one way to interpret that. I don't believe any of those things in terms of those facts happened in this matter. Otherwise, claims against Rashonda Brooks would still be a part of this matter and they wouldn't be dismissed. However, I don't believe that that's the case. But I do believe that even here today, the appellant has made the argument that the examination was a sham. So that's the point that I was trying to get after. Not that he put that into his complaint, but that here today, they retreat from that position by saying that, well, what we asked them to do and how we got leave, and even though we were on leave for several months before retiring and taking a full pension at full pay, before those things happened, he facilitated a sham examination.
Thank you.
Just some quick rebuttal, Your Honor. He didn't facilitate the examination. They sent him to the examination. But just to correct...
That's the IME examination, right? The independent medical examiner, not the examination by CARMO.
They also sent him to that. They told him he would get FMLA leave, and he needed to go see his doctor. They filled out the form, and they sent the form to the physician, who then...
To a physician of his choosing, correct?
Yes, his choosing.
And so you agree that CARMO's evaluation is also in this record?
It is. It's
and
mentioned.
It's mentioned, okay.
But just to correct some facts, the IME was not voluntary. On the fifth day when he was supposed to return to work, they delivered a letter, hand-delivered a letter, and told him he could not come back to work, and he had to go to their IME. He never went back to work, so that's incorrect. In addition...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can I ask one other question? So you agree it was proper for the district court to both consider, and I'm messing up all these names, I apologize, Ager, the independent medical examiner, and CARMO?
They never considered Ager, and the decision of the district court was based on Dr. CARMO's evaluation.
And you're not saying that was improper. You're saying just the conclusion it formed from that was improper.
That is correct, and that he's allowed to present facts to show that he could... perform the essential functions of the job under the Henschel framework. Also, the due process issue, it is not true that he met with his union rep before he was disciplined, Your Honor. And the court has all of the records, and the court will be able to see this. The testimony is the first time he was aware of a discipline was at the disciplinary hearing. It lasted 10 minutes. He was presented with a completed disciplinary form that already had the infractions and the penalty. They only required him to sign. He never met with a union rep before. In addition, with respect to whether or not...
Does that matter for a due process claim?
It does. Because the union, the requirements of the collective bargaining agreement that has been talked about...
Could he have filed a grievance?
He never got back to work, Your Honor.
But could he have filed a grievance?
Probably, but he was never even allowed to get back onto the premises after all of this. He never went back to work. So that is incorrect. And I just want to address quickly this issue as to whether or not a verbal reminder is equivalent to the notice board. One, it is not, because the verbal exhortation is immediate. It's direct. And it has the likelihood.
He conceded he saw the notice.
He did, but
so why does it matter if it's verbal or in writing? As long as he gets the notice and disregards it, why is that relevant?
Because it's not equivalent. Because the verbal exhortation has the more immediate impact of letting the individual perform the task, and it's cumulative. Mr. Russo has testified that he repeatedly talked to Crossman about tasks that had been neglected and that Crossman needed to perform. In addition, and this is very important, Mr. Marshall testified, and it's undisputed and unrefuted, that there were instances where, despite Mr. Russo, the supervisor, talking to Mr. Crossman, he still didn't perform the task and he was never disciplined. So I think that supersedes even the issues to whether or not they were equivalency between the verbal exhortation and the notice board. Because even despite all of that, there were instances where Mr. Crossman was spoken to by his supervisor. Mr. Crossman still did not do the task, and he was not disciplined. And we believe.
What are you referring to in terms of evidence of that?
The testimony of Mr. Marshall. It's in the record. And it was never refuted. And Mr. Crossman has admitted that he would speak repeatedly to Mr. Crossman, Mr. Russo, that he would speak repeatedly to Mr. Crossman, and that he had never disciplined him at any time for failure to perform his task.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Both of you, thank you for your argument, and the case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn court.